Good morning, everyone. I'd like to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary and welcome everyone here. This is our first meeting for the 75th Legislative Assembly, and thank you very much. And what we're going to do is kind of go through some formalities before we get started today, because this is our first meeting. And I'm going to first start off with introductions. I think is probably the most important aspect for everyone who knows who's who. And I'm going to start with Bill Taylor, our counsel. And Bill, I'd like for you to go ahead and take a moment to kind of give us a kind of an overview, and if you would be so kind to acknowledge and introduce
our staff. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Down to my left is Shannon Seville, who comes to us from the Multnomah District Attorney's Office and who's been here a long line of lawyers, very competent lawyers from that office. She has a background in criminal law. Next to her is Anna Braun. I believe this is your third session and will be doing a lot of work in the tort area and the civil law area. This is now my start of my 12th session. I came here in 1987 and thought I was going to be here 6 months and still here. Anola DeJong was our committee assistant back in 2001. She has now, if Patsy Wood can be replaced, she has succeeded to Patsy's position and will be our office manager. Sitting down there at the, behind the screen, looking very intently at the screen, is Courtney Johnson. And Courtney just graduated from Willamette last May. And somewhere I saw earlier was Jennifer Ransom Smith, our other committee assistant. She's waving from the back.
You can't get away with that. You have to come up so everyone gets to see you. Great.
Hi. And Diane Fire also is another committee assistant.
Okay, I didn't see Diane here. Okay, thank you.
All right, great. So at this point, what I'm going to do is ask each of the members to introduce themselves, to a little brief, description of yourself as to the area of the state you represent. And then I have two points I'd like for you to tell all of us. And that is, one, what is a hobby of yours? And two, what do you do for stress release? And they cannot be the same. So, being fair, I guess maybe I should start off myself and give everyone their opportunity to figure out what they're going to say. My district is Senate District 4. It represents a good portion of Lane County, all of East Lane County and the Cascades, and the southern part of Lane County, as well as in northern Douglas County and all of East Douglas County. It's pretty diverse. It includes, let's say, features such as the University of Oregon, as well as very small rural communities, as you can imagine, throughout the two counties. What I do as a hobby, I brew beer. I've been a home brewer since 1987 and still have people drink it, so I guess it's okay. Stress release, my bicycling. It's my avid cyclist, and that's what I do for stress release and helping me cope with mental issues. And let's see, I will then call on our co-chair, Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Brian Boquist. I represent the Senate District 12, which is 23 and 24th House districts, which starts with six people just in Junction City, which is technically Lane County. And then I sweep across every timberland, agricultural area, and find a few citizens as we come north all the way to Yamhill County. And so I have rural Benton, rural Lynn, rural Polk, rural Yamhill County, and I do have McMinnville now, which is the 24th district. I like to shoot skeet and ice climb, and I work out fairly regularly, at least three times a week, to reduce stress, and when that doesn't work, I go back to shooting skeet.
Okay, and Doug.
I'm Doug Whitsett. I live out of 20 miles east of Klamath Falls. I represent all or parts of five counties, all of Klamath, Lake, and Cook counties, the eastern part of Deschutes County, and about a third of Jackson County. It includes Eagle Point. So it's the second largest district in the state. It's primarily agriculture, forestry, natural resource-based economy. For hobby, I do, we have a little farm. I do some, just putter around on the farm. I also use that for stress release as well as hot, as well as a hot tub. And occasionally shooting. Helps a lot, doesn't it, Brian?
Mr. Chair, I love skeets because I can, you know, then put little signals and things on those little skeet
right.
that go out.
So. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is the northeast corner of Washington County and the northwest corner of Multnomah County. I have a very culturally and socially diverse district. My district includes both the Pearl District and Nike, but also Forest Park and large areas of unincorporated Washington County. I would consider my hobby traveling, although recently most of it has been college trips with my kids or visiting my son, who goes to school on the East Coast. I like international travel. I haven't done enough of it lately, but I still have relatives in Italy and like to visit them. Stress release. I have my daughter has a Cocker Spaniel who likes to walk, and I love taking long walks with her and working out.
And Jackie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be serving on Judiciary. I served my first session 2001-2002, so it's really exciting to be back on the Judiciary Committee. And I'm, as a non-attorney, I will say that I sort of joke that being on the Judiciary Committee is like going to law school without going into debt. And so I certainly appreciate the opportunity to have a legal training without having that financial burden. But in regards to hobbies, I share with my colleague, Senator Bonamici, love of traveling and just returned from the Middle East, spent about 3.5 weeks there. And I've been sharing a little bit of discussions with my colleague who also has done a lot of world traveling. Stress release, I share with the chair, a love for cycling, and so you may see us out when we're not here out on our bikes relieving some of the stress of the session. And avid cyclist, the hardest thing about coming to Salem is not by commuting down here, which I do in Portland. The district I represent, as you know, is pretty compact. It's all within Multnomah County. Represent District 23, which is northeast and now southeast Portland. Goes all the way from the Columbia River down south, still within the city of Portland, but obviously have a lot of issues that deal with legal issues, work very closely with Multnomah County. So I'm in my eighth year of public service, and it's an honor to be here.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. One other, I guess, couple of formalities is timing of meeting. Our slot is from 8 to 10. Today we start at 8:30, and it's the chair's, desire to not have us meet the full 2 hours unless we actually need to meet the full 2 hours. That's why we will have somewhat of a float schedule as we get started until we start getting a full agenda or docket of bills to actually start processing that will take the full time. So one of the, areas of, hopefully that we can all agree to get here as quickly on time as we can. Since we have the first slot in the morning, hopefully we'll be able to all be here within whatever the designated time for start so we can get going and move through the day and hopefully not put anyone behind on their time commitments. Regarding attendance, of course, it's flexible, but we definitely need to have a quorum. And if one of the members is going to have issues of for time management for a particular meeting, if you could let the chair know and staff, then that we can coordinate around that. Our days of meeting are 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday. And let's see, I think that takes care of the formalities. Bill, I know we need to adopt the rules. And we have the bill introduction. We should probably do the rules before we do the bill introduction. Is there anything else that we need to cover in formalities?
Chair, members of the committee, I can't think of anything. We covered everything once we do the rules.
All right. So, Bill, why don't you go ahead and give us the overview as to the rules and what, if any, changes may be from the model rules, if there are any.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are model rules that come from the Secretary of the Senate's office. The only change that we have made to them is we put Senate model rules at the top. We've made no changes to the rules. In fact, we're not allowed to make any changes.
All right. So the rules that we're going to be voting on, members, is exactly what should be the rules for all of the committees that we'll be serving on in whatever capacity as committee members.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So the chair will take a motion as to the adoption of the proposed rules. Senator Boycrest, we can get points.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate that the Judiciary Committee adopt the Senate model rules.
Senator Boycrest has made a motion for us to adopt the proposed Senate model rules. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Bill. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have LC 235 in front of you. This is relating to forfeitures. It's a product of a work group. As you may know, we've done a lot in this area in the last several years. In fact, we had one legislative referral to the voters that amended the Constitution that makes in this bill as a follow-up to that, the cleanup to that, and also when enacted will clear up some potential constitutional ambiguities.
All right. So a little bit more background on this. This is a work product of what has happened since Measure 3 was passed. And there was some work with the advocate groups that basically made some agreements that certain things would occur depending on whether or not the courts had ruled on Measure 3 as being constitutional or not constitutional. My understanding that there's still some of the framework that needed to be addressed that's going to be included in LC 235?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It will have a statutory framework to carry out what was enacted by the voters, but it also reenacts the bill that you worked on several sessions ago for one simple reason. What is hanging out there is the potential of, because the Supreme Court found the original Measure 3 constitutional, whether that act that you passed was in fact still constitutional, and whether a bill, a law, springs back into constitutionality because it's now found constitutional. And this will clarify that. Right now, most police departments are being very cautious about instituting forfeitures because of the ambiguity that exists in the law right now.
Yes.
So this is a product of the district, we work with the District Attorney's Association, the Attorney General's Office, the Criminal Defense Bar,
ACLU.
This is a consensus product, and it is sort of cleanup and a clarification.
And the hope is, members, is that once this is passed, if it is in fact passed, it will in fact allow for the forfeitures that are permitted under law to be able to move forward and actually be processed where currently they're not, or limitedly are. So the chair will take a motion as to the adoption, or introduction, I should say, of LC 235. And this is basically just to introduce it as a committee bill, and then it will be put in the process for deliberation, just like any other bill that will come before this committee. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that LC 235 be adopted as a committee bill, and then I'll speak to my motion afterwards, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boycrest has moved that we adopt LC 235 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just to my motion, I've not read it in depth, and I've been involved in this issue in the other chamber when I was there, and so I'll reserve my final determinations at that time. But I'd like to move forward with this, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Any objection? Not seeing or hearing any, so adopted. And that's going to move us into our informational meeting for today, and it's my pleasure and honor to be able to welcome many of the members of the judicial branch that are here today to give us an overview of how the courts work one of the branches of government, as well as how they work with legislation, or let's say interpreting of laws that are passed, and how, if necessary, they will actually review our legislative work as to how a bill became a law and what is, in fact, or was the intent, if necessary, if we weren't quite as clear as we should have been in the actual adoption of a measure to make it clear that they do not need to go, let's say, beyond the face of the document itself. So with that, Chief Justice, I should say, Dave Brewer's here with us. He's the Chief Judge for the Court of Appeals. And Dave, I'm going to ask you if you'd be so kind to come on up and bring your associates with you and allow y'all to make your introductions and then walk us through.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dave Brewer, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, and I thank you today on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department for the opportunity to appear before this committee as a member of a panel that will discuss with you the process of statutory interpretation in Oregon courts. And it will be my pleasure in a moment to introduce two of my colleagues, Justice Virginia Linder and Judge Jack Landau. But before doing so, I'd like to just take one moment and place today's discussion in its broader context. As most of you know, in the last half of the 20th century, a major change occurred in the development of the law in this country. Whereas previously most of the law that was applied in our courts came from the common law, and much of that common law had its origins predating the founding of our government. After the 1950s or thereabouts, state legislatures became much more active in developing the law through the enactment of legislation. And as a result, the role of courts changed as well. The Court of Appeals, on which Judge Landau and I sit, hears nearly all of the initial appeals from all trial court and agency decisions in the state of Oregon. And today, I conservatively estimate that more than three-quarters of those appeals primarily involve disputes about the meaning of statutes. And for us, that enterprise focuses first and foremost, as the Chair so eloquently stated, on what the legislature that enacted the statute intended for the words that it chose to mean. And to make that determination, it's critical to have practical, predictable, and reliable rules of interpretation. Those rules in Oregon have developed over time from two sources. Some of them have been developed by courts as issues have emerged from particular cases on appeal. But equally, and more importantly, are the principles that you yourselves have enacted in the form of statutes that tell the courts, in some circumstances, how we should determine a statute's meaning. And so we've provided, through the courtesy of Mr. Taylor, each of you with a handout that I hope you have that sets out the statutes that describe the most commonly used legislative principles of construction. And we hope that those statutes will be of some use to you as the session unfolds. So with that preface, it's my pleasure to introduce to you two of my colleagues today. First, Judge Landau, seated to my right. Jack Landau is presiding judge of Department 2, one of the regular panels of the Court of Appeals. He's an Oregonian. He's a graduate of Franklin High School in Portland, Lewis and Clark College, and Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark. He also has an advanced law degree from the University of Virginia. Judge Landau has served as a judge on our court since 1992, for 17 years now. He's the second longest serving judge on our court. Before coming to the court, he had extensive experience in the private practice of law and served as Deputy Attorney General for Oregon. He's one of the leading scholars and teachers in this state on the subject of statutory interpretation. He'll take the lead in our presentation. Justice Virginia Linder, seated to Judge Landau's right, was elected to the Oregon Supreme Court in 2006. She is also an Oregonian. She's a graduate of Southern Oregon University and Willamette University College of Law. Before being elected to the Supreme Court, she served on the Court of Appeals from 1997 through 2005. Before that, she had an illustrious career in the Attorney General's office, capping that career as Oregon's top appellate lawyer, the Solicitor General. Like Judge Landau, Justice Linder is a clear and careful thinker and writer. And her role today will be to briefly describe to you the overall approach that appellate judges, sort of a glimpse into the mind, if you will, take in tackling statutory construction problems. We're very mindful of your time constraints, but what I want to tell you is this. We hope to have a start a dialogue here today, this session, as we've done in past sessions, that would be helpful to you in explaining how we do our work. Because our goal is to go beyond the traditional relationships where courts, sometimes many years after a statute is enacted, have a one-way communication with a current legislature in the form of a written opinion telling you all what we think the earlier legislature meant when it enacted statutes. That doesn't seem like the best way to communicate about how we all do our work, so we really are grateful for the opportunity to be able to have a useful exchange with you today and throughout session. We want this to be a conversation, so please interrupt us with any questions you have at any time. We're mindful of your time constraints, so we'll be as brief as we can. With that, Judge Landau.
Thank you, Chief. We all welcome this opportunity to have a conversation with you. We have a sort of conversation in a more formal way when you draft statutes and we interpret them and then you read them and then maybe respond to them. Scholars often call that a conversation. That takes a long time. And it's a real treat for us to have a more informal conversation where we can actually question one another about the work that we do. What we're going to talk about this morning is just that, the work, the point at which our work and your work intersects. You draft statutes, we try to figure out what they mean and apply them. And what we hope to do this morning is give you an overview of the rules that govern what we do, so that perhaps you can make your intentions clearer when working on your side of the equation, you draft the words that we have to interpret. So what I want to do is talk briefly about who we are, what we do, and how we do it, with a particular focus on the rules of statutory interpretation. I know that some of you have heard this before, so echoing what Chief Judge Brewer just said, please interrupt if you have any questions. If you want me to kind of short circuit some part of this or other, I won't be offended. We're here to help you to have a fruitful conversation. We are the judges of the state's appellate courts. What that means is that we review the decisions of administrative agencies and trial courts. We're primarily what is known as an error-correcting court, particularly the Court of Appeals. Our job is not to make law. That's your job. Our job is to ensure that the trial courts and the agencies correctly apply the law in the decisions that they make. If they commit reversible error in applying that law, we then explain the reasons for our decision to reverse in published opinions that we hope will guide parties, lawyers, and legislators in the future. In deciding whether an agency or a trial court has followed the law, it's important for us to take a moment just to spell out what we mean when we say the law, because it actually covers quite a few different things. First and foremost, it covers federal law. We won't spend much time at all talking about that this morning, but it's just important to point out that under our federal constitution, the federal law is the supreme law of the land, the federal constitution and federal statutes. So, for example, several years ago, there was quite a controversial decision that has had quite an influence on the work of our courts and the legislature when the United States Supreme Court decided in Blakely versus the state of Washington that the state of Washington sentencing guidelines scheme was unconstitutional because it permitted trial judges to make findings of fact that affected the sentence under the state sentencing guidelines. We had to follow that case because our sentencing guideline scheme looks an awful lot like the Washington one. There was no real way we could distinguish it. Whether we agreed with the United States Supreme Court or not really didn't matter because the decisions of the United States Supreme Court about matters of federal constitutional law are the supreme law of the land, and we are all bound to follow them. Fortunately, there are very few of our cases that involve federal law. The vast majority of our cases involve state law. State law comes in at least four different varieties: the state constitution, state statutes, administrative regulations and rules, and the common law. What we want to talk about today is the first two of those, the state constitution and the state statutes. Justice Kistler and Judge Schumann will talk to you about the constitutional aspect of it. So we will not, this morning, my panel here won't spend much time talking about that, except to say it's always out there. It's something that we will always look for. The constitution allocates power to the various branches of government and then limits the way in which that power can be exercised, and there are specific limits on the kinds of laws that legislatures can pass. So, for example, the legislature could not pass a law, I suppose it could pass it, but the law would be unconstitutional, that said that the penalty for a crime is one sentence if the defendant is black and another if the crime is committed, the same crime is committed by a white person. You can't do that under Article 1, Section 20 of the Constitution. What we will talk about is the statutory variety of the law. We're talking about here the 21 volumes of statutes and growing, it seems, relating to everything from abandoned property to zoning. Those statutes represent your collective wisdom about various issues of concern to the state of Oregon. As long as that judgment doesn't violate the state or the federal constitution, it's binding. It is the law. It's binding on us. It's binding on every party that comes before us. You should understand that we like that arrangement. We didn't become judges because we want to be policymakers. That's your job. Our job is to apply the law, make sure that the trial courts and the administrative agencies follow it. So what we need to talk about is how we apply that law. What are the rules that govern our decisions in figuring out whether the administrative agencies and the trial courts accurately read it and apply it? As Chief Judge Brewer said, if you open up any volume of the reported decisions of the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals at random, you'll find that anywhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of those decisions are about statutory construction. It's not constitutional law. It's not common law. Primarily, the work of the appellate courts in the 21st century is reading statutes, figuring out what they mean, and applying them to the facts of particular cases. So our primary function is to interpret statutes. Fortunately, in the vast majority of those cases, the statutes are very clear. I've been teaching legislation now for 17 years at Willamette. In fact, you'll probably see throughout the course of this semester, a lot of students popping in and out. In my first class, I encourage them to come visit this committee and the House Judiciary Committee as good examples of how the committee process in Oregon works. And Oregon statutes, by and large, are very well done. If you have any doubts about that, just pick up at random any volume or any portion of the Internal Revenue Code. Oregon has a very, very talented staff at Legislative Council and really does produce very high-quality work. But in some cases, several hundred a year, I know that sounds like a lot, but as Chief Judge Brewer said, we hear a lot of cases. We hear anywhere between we get 3,000 to 4,000 filings a year. Okay, so out of those, 300 to 400 cases will generate an opinion, and about three-quarters of those will involve some disputes about the meaning of statutes. Sometimes that uncertainty arises because it's just the nature of language. Sometimes words just aren't as clear as we'd like them to be. Sometimes the uncertainty arises because of political compromises, and the ambiguity is intentional. I've actually seen cases when I've gone through the legislative history in which a committee won't be able to agree on what it wants to do, and it intentionally picks a word. And I remember the chair of the committee at that point said, "We wish the Court of Appeals luck." Sometimes it's a result of accidentally poor drafting with 3,000 bills and 5,000 amendments a year. It's remarkable that the work is as high quality as it is. And most of the time I think it's because none of us can anticipate all the possible applications of the statute. You have a particular problem that prompts you to draft a statute, and you draft the language as clearly as you think you can, and somewhere along the line there will come a fact situation, a set of parties, and will present a problem that may or may not apply. And it's just not something that you could have anticipated. Those are the kinds of cases that we face very commonly in trying to figure out what the statutes mean. We figure out how statutes mean by a series of rules. As Judge Brewer said, those rules come from either, or actually from both, two sources. The first is from you, the legislature. In ORS Chapter 174, there's a compilation of rules that have been developed over the centuries, literally. Some of those rules date back to the original DD Code in 1862, and some of them are more recent vintage. Those are decisions of the legislature about what it intends when it uses various words, presumptions that the legislature would like the court to apply when figuring out the effect of various kinds of statutes, what happens when you don't have a severability clause, what happens when you repeal a statute, what happens when you repeal the repealer, lots of fun things like that. Also, the rules of construction are developed by the courts themselves. For the last 500 years, at least, courts have been interpreting statutes, and they've developed a series of rules that continue to be used to this day. Probably the most important rule for our purposes is one that is stated in the statute itself, and it is the one that says that the goal of statutory construction is to ascertain the legislature's intentions. That's what we try to accomplish when we look at statutes. It's not a question of whether we agree with the statute or disagree with it. It's a question of what we think you wanted the statute to mean when you enacted it. We accomplish that by essentially a three-step process. The first step is that we will look at the text of the statute. That is always the most important step, and we'll spend the most time talking about that. The second step is, if there's an ambiguity in the statute, we'll look at legislative history to help us resolve that ambiguity. The third step is that we will look at any of a number of rules of construction, lawyers call them canons or maxims of construction, that were developed as kind of tiebreakers. When all else fails and we don't know what the legislature intended, these are rules that we will rely on. Let's talk about each of those three steps in some more detail. In looking at the text of the statute, the most important thing to understand is that we are limited by the words of the statute that are actually there. If there's anything that you take away from my remarks this morning, I would suggest that this is it. Your intentions are the touchstone for our work, but those intentions have to be put into words in the statute, or we can't do anything about it. Okay. So we can implement your intentions only if they're in the words of the statute. So, for example, if the legislature accidentally leaves words out of the statute, we know that's a mistake. And we know what the legislature intended. We lack the statutory and constitutional authority to put those words back in. One of the provisions, ORS Chapter 174, says that the office of the judge is to declare what's in the statute, taking nothing away from it that is there and putting nothing into it that's not there. So even if you make a mistake, we can't fix it by putting the words back in. We're limited by those words. Most of the time, the words are there, and the question is what they mean. In determining the meaning of the words, we will always follow your lead. Those words mean whatever you want them to mean, as long as you put those definitions into the statute. right? So if you want, for example, motor vehicle in the motor vehicle code to include skateboards, all you have to do is say so. Put it in a statute that motor vehicle means or at least includes skateboards, motorized or not. It doesn't matter. It means whatever you want them to mean as long as you say. We actually had a case on that, by the way. We travel around the state and hold hearings at high schools, and it just so happened that my panel heard that case. We had a room full of about 500 very, very anxious students wanting to know if a skateboard was within the vehicle code. If you do not define those terms, then what we will do is try to figure out what you most likely would have intended them to mean. In the absence of a definition, what we're going to do is go to a dictionary, because the idea is we're all ordinary people, and we assume that you use words in their ordinary senses. And so a record of the ordinary meaning of terms is a dictionary. We tend to look at, in the Oregon courts, Webster's Third New International Dictionary, not because we got a volume discount from the publishers, but because that dictionary is almost uniquely a dictionary of usage as opposed to so-called correct meaning. There are different views about dictionaries, and the Webster's Dictionary records actual usage, so it includes words like ain't, for example. It drives grammarians crazy. It includes words like, drives me crazy. So I'm, like, really upset about that. That's a record of ordinary meaning, and so it's most likely going to reflect the meaning that you intend when you drafted the statute.
Jack, can I ask you a question, though? Because we're all used to opening that Webster's, and we'll see a word where the definitions are so lengthy and so complex that they take up a whole column or a half a column. Sometimes those definitions are inconsistent with each other. Other times, they just make the meaning of the word really broad. So what in the heck do we do then?
That's a really good question. There is, for example, in Webster's Dictionary, the word set, three-letter word. There are 200 separate definitions to the word set. I had no idea there could be so many variations of such a simple word. That's actually very common. The answer is words tell us what words, or I mean, dictionaries tell us what words can mean. It lists the reasonable possibilities. What you most likely intended the word actually to mean is going to depend on how it was used in the sentence. We'll look for the definition that fits most closely with the context. How did you use it in the sentence? How is the sentence used in the section? How does the section compare with other sections? We want to see if there are any patterns to the way you use it. For example, we had a case some years ago that involved the term public land. The criminal statutes concerning drug operations provide that if there is a marijuana grow, for example, on public land, then the penalty is actually higher than if the marijuana was grown on private land. And in that particular case, the defendant was an employee of Pacific University, private employer, and he was growing the marijuana in the basement of a laboratory in this private building. Pacific University, though, was leasing the land from the United States Forest Service. So the state argued that's public land. The defendant argued, no, it's not. It's private land. The defendant cited the dictionary. The dictionary definition under Webster's defined public land as unappropriated land that belongs to the government. The statute itself didn't define the term. So what we did is we looked at the term as it's used elsewhere in the statute. And it turns out it was used some 300 different times in the Oregon Revised Statutes. And in many of those cases, it was actually defined. And it was defined much more narrowly to mean, or much more broadly, I should say, any land that's held entitled by the government. And so we said, well, the land here is held entitled by the federal government, and so this is public land, and so this person was, in fact, subject to the stiffer penalty. The point is, we look at the context of how words are used in the particular statute, in other statutes like it, and throughout the code to see if we can get some evidence of how you most likely intended those words to be used. Okay?
Yeah, and what I want to do for dialogue here is not going through the chair. If you have a question, just go ahead and ask.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about that situation. What is the significance of any of the fact that it wasn't defined in that particular statute, but it was defined in other places?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I don't know if it has any particular significance beyond the fact that we don't have a definition to work with. Legislatures frequently don't have time or don't think that a word needs definition, or they think, I talked to some friends of mine in the legislature who expressed surprise that such a word would even require definition because it seems pretty clear. There's a variety of reasons why you might not include the definition. It's of no particular consequence to us except that the definition makes it easier for us to figure out what you intended.
Jack, can I ask you this, though? I think the situation in that case was one where the term was defined in a different chapter. And so isn't it true in circumstances like that, we don't just automatically borrow that definition because it might be in a context that would require a different understanding, but we check that context out to see if it's essentially the same type of analysis that you're dealing with in the chapter where the term isn't defined, rather than just blindly borrow it. Is that fair?
That's a real good point. Again, we're looking for evidence of what you most likely intended, and we're going to have a stronger argument about what you intended if we have definitions in similar kinds of statutes. You know, if we have a public lands case or a public lands definition in perhaps another criminal statute, well, that's a really strong argument that the legislature most likely intended it to apply to this other criminal statute. In that particular case, what we found was there were so many public lands definitions, even if they didn't have anything to do with criminal law, they were uniform. There were no departures from that very broad definition that we thought it was a fair inference that the legislature would have intended the same thing in this particular case. But it's about inferences and the strength of those inferences. And as Chief Judge Brewer said, the closer you can get to the subject matter, the more confident we feel that that's more likely what you intended. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
So, yes, my turn if you would, Mr. Chair. Sure. I'm the novice here, but having served on Revenue Committee, I'm really familiar with your revenue examples you're talking about. So what I'm trying to do is determine in the statute, 174.020, you mentioned written word, and it talks about history of the statute, or we're talking about legislative intent. So let me throw a revenue example out here and try and get an interpretation. And this has all been resolved, so it's not a conflict of interest. But I think several of you know I might have a conflict of interest because I'm trying to enforce the law within the judiciary in a few places right now. So under the Revenue Committee, we had a situation, and this is where it's a very odd definition, a definition that was not common. In fact, in this particular definition is, you know, what constitutes active duty or active military service, so on and so forth like that. And again, this has all been resolved. But we in the committee, because there wasn't a real clear definition, but there was a clear federal definition in federal law, stated over and over in the committee this was our intent, even though that law, the way it was written, you know, might not be clear for you, I guess you would say, because you'd never seen the term before. And in this case had multiple agencies, not the judiciary, but multiple agencies come up to the diocese there and us talk about this and say this is the definition, and everybody nod their head, and then we all leave the session, and lo and behold, when they go to the administrative rules process, they've just done a 180-degree turn and go the exact opposite direction, despite the public record and the tapes and everything else showing this is not what we intended. Can you give me a little up? Because I've always been under the impression, especially in revenue and other committees, you get up and sometimes you make these speeches so it's in the record so that if it is challenged, the court knows. It says, okay, look, the carrier of the bill, who was supposed to be the expert, and the staff said X, Y, Z verbally, but it didn't come in writing. But I really focus on your term. It says, what does the written word say? So are we wasting our time by these speeches and trying to reinforce this to provide intent, or is intent purely written?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that's a great question and a perfect segue to where I'm going next. If a statute is so clear that it can mean one and only one thing. This doesn't happen very often. But if it's so clear that it just can't mean anything else, then we're done. And it doesn't matter what the legislative history says, because whatever the legislative history says, it couldn't change what the language can mean. If the language is capable of more than one reasonable construction, if it's ambiguous, and language frequently is ambiguous, then what we try to figure out is, from among these different reasonable possibilities, what did the legislature most likely intend? Which from among those choices is the one the legislature wanted? That's where we go to legislative history, and that's why we do it. We look at whatever we can find in the bill file, in the CDs of committee hearings, work sessions, and floor debates. We want some clue about what the legislature was thinking about the problem, the nature of the problem that was being solved. Sometimes that can help us figure out what the legislature intended. We're looking at any specific comments about language changes, about amendments, about language choices. All that stuff is absolutely important.
Jack, I think a really good way to give some meat to that answer, too, is to talk a little bit to the committee about this hierarchy that has developed over the years in terms of how the courts have traditionally viewed legislative history's weight. In other words, what counts the most and why. Would that be helpful to you? And Judge Landau can give you a good primer on that.
Give a real good example of a case in which we use legislative history. A fun case in which there's a statute that makes it illegal to alter a license plate. And it defines alteration of a license plate by obscuring the numbers, letters, or registration stickers. And somebody got one of these license plate frames that said, you know, I'd rather be shopping at Nordstrom's or something. And it blocked the word Oregon. It didn't block the actual license plate numbers and letters, but it did block, in part, the word Oregon. The question for us is, did that constitute an alteration of the license plate? It did technically alter the numbers or letters. Oregon is spelled with letters. But are those the letters that the legislature really cared about? So we looked at the legislative history, and we found from the committee hearings that what the committee was really interested in were those big numbers and letters by which police officers and other people can identify vehicles, and the fact that Oregon was partially blocked didn't really count. Right? The legislative history helped us sort that out. As Judge Brewer said, sometimes we talk about a hierarchy in federal cases where there is just a raft of legislative history. If you have a printing office that works three shifts, 24 hours a day, cranking the stuff out, there's a lot of legislative history, and a hierarchy has been developed so that the most important thing in the federal cases is the written committee report, since the committees generate, you know, large volumes. Going section by section, this is what we're trying to do, this is what the each section means, floor debates, statements of sponsors, and so forth. We have less legislative history because we are our state has a citizen legislature that meets every other year for 6 months or so without the kind of staffing. We just don't have as much legislative history to work with. So we're not quite as picky as the federal courts are. We will look at anything and everything we can find in the file that will help us understand what you intended. That said, there's some stuff that's frankly better than other stuff, right? Statements of lobbyists, for example, do not get a lot of weight in the courts. I remember a time when a lobbyist was testifying before a committee on some workers' compensation legislation, and a legislator interrupted with a question. And the lobbyist held up his hand and said, excuse me, just a second, I'm trying to make some legislative history here. And not surprisingly, the legislator said, excuse me, but I think we're the ones who make the legislative history. And the legislator was right. Legislative history is about what you intended the words to mean, and lobbyist statements are a relatively poor indicator of that. Having said that, we all know that sometimes the nature of the bill very technical environmental legislation, for example, legislation involving the work of state agencies, requires that you hear from and rely on statements of experts, statements of agency officials, and sometimes statements of private lobbyists. To the extent that you find that information useful, important, expressive of what you think the bill means, what you should do then is say that. Put that on the record, and then we can say, it's very clear here, that although, you know, Mr. or Ms. Lobbyist said such and such, that's not just the statement of a private party who's paid to take a position. That is reflective of what the committee most likely intended this bill to mean. So that's something that you could do to kind of raise the profile of that legislative history. Oregon has, as you know, a very committee-oriented legislative process because there are no possibility for amendments on the floor. So that means that what goes on here in the committee can be very important, particularly in work session. So there's your opportunity to make statements about what you intend the words to mean. We will listen to those very carefully. One of my favorite examples is an example in when Representative Kevin Mannix was in committee, had proposed an amendment to a statute that would, in effect, alter the interpretation of that statute by the Court of Appeals. And what he said was, in the work session, are you listening, Court of Appeals? Are you listening, Workers' Compensation Board, when you read the transcript of this hearing? This is what we are accomplishing with this amendment. And lo and behold, in Safe versus Drews, the Oregon Supreme Court quoted that in block, in extensive portion, saying it's very clear what the legislature intended this to mean. So statements in the committee at work session in particular, by yourselves as you're working through this language, can be very, very helpful.
What about floor statements, Jack?
The third thing that I would say is floor statements can be very helpful. The theory is that the more legislators are actually there, and so it is later in the process, there's a greater number of legislators actually listening, and so it carries some weight, because if somebody objected, particularly when somebody like the person who is carrying the bill is saying, this is what we heard in committee, this is the problem we're trying to correct, this is how we think the bill corrects it, you would think that somebody would object if that were not an accurate representation of the legislature's intentions. So we will look at that very carefully. I know in some cases legislators will actually put together a colloquy.
I think we both have the same question, Bill.
You go for it. I had a comment about how we set that up one time and ran afoul of something else. But yeah.
So when you have that type of lively debate on the floor, does the court give more precedent to a member who, let's say, is either the carrier or someone that says, I was in this committee, this is what we discussed, and this is what we meant, in response to a statement that another member may say on the floor that was not engaged at that earlier discussions and level?
I can't give you a categorical answer, and this would be the gospel according to Landau in any event, but I would say that the clearer the statement, the better. To the extent that it is a person who was with the committee, it would carry more weight, it seems to me, with the court, because that was the person who was in the committee, hearing the testimony, listening to the witnesses, has a better appreciation for the problem that precipitated this bill, and is more likely to have an accurate feel for what this bill is supposed to accomplish.
Okay. We've had several situations, haven't we, Jack, where the courts have emphasized that the fact that the floor statement was made by a bill carrier. So that does seem to have extra weight in the cases.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we one time set up this process in 1993 where the chairman of the committee carried the bill, made a statement. We knew the bill would be subject to litigation. It was subject to litigation. One of the people you'll hear from later was representing the Department of Justice at the time, and he asked me about the statement. I said, yes, it was made on the record. What happened is when the keywords were made, the tapes were flipped on the floor. So fortunately, it was found through another source, but the tapes off the floor, it's like it never happened. So it was the best laid plans of mice and men going astray, at least to a certain extent. But we found it through actually legislative media and one of the TV stations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, the carrier thing, I'm intrigued by the carrier point, because under our rules, which carry the weight of the law, The carrier is the person who defines and explains the intent of the bill to the members on the floor. So, and when you start looking at a hierarchy, you got the carrier, you know, and then you may have somebody opposing it to it, or you may have the committee chair who speaks to it, who you think, okay, there's someone who understands the intent in the committee, that they would be not just slightly higher, but like way higher. And then you have other documents that I'm wondering about comments. We have staff measure summaries that, you know, is the explanation that was given to everybody on the floor. And I'm not one who makes the speeches, and Senator Bonamici's been on my side when I've been over there. And I tend to take the staff measure summary and highlight what I'm going to say when I'm the carrier of the bill. I don't dream something up myself. And so I read verbatim off that staff measure summary because that's what everybody else has. And I guess the words aren't there. So it seems, and then we have fiscal revenue statements. You know, what was the sponsor's intent, things like that. And you've kind of said that the carrier, he has a little bit more weight than everybody else. But it doesn't sound, even though you say there's a hierarchy, it doesn't really sound like there's a hierarchy. It sounds like there's a pie. Is that closer to the analogy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I think that's fair. We can talk in the abstract about there being a hierarchy, but I'd have to tell you in the real world there's so little legislative history frequently that is pertinent that we're going to grab at anything and everything that we can find that provides some basis for drawing an inference about the legislature's intent. And then the question will just be how strong or weak an argument you can make from a particular piece of evidence about that legislative intent.
Would it be fair to say, Jack, that in some ways this is like detective work, and often you don't have all the evidence that you would like to have, and you're sifting through it, and because you can have different kinds of history from bill to bill, it's hard to adopt categorical rules when you're looking at all the evidence. But I think the things we're telling you today do seem to carry special weight in the cases, and so we want to let you know what those things are.
I understand that, but, I mean, under our rules, which again carry the weight of the law, I mean, there is a body of evidence, period. It doesn't go to the floor, and we don't vote on it unless it has a staff measure summary, unless it has, you know, gone through a work session, unless it has got a carrier on the floor. And so there is a body regardless, and under whichever chamber, but if it has fiscal and revenue, it has those statements. So I was kind of like trying to figure out those things that we must prepare. Is there any of those that are more important than the other one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, sure. As was said, if you have statements of the carrier, it's going to carry more weight. Staff measure summaries, by the way, is something that we look at quite a bit. If it's there, they're usually pretty brief, and often because of the nature of these problems, they won't address the specific issue that we're about. But this raises a very interesting point that, frankly, the courts haven't written a lot about, which is that sometimes the legislature itself has its own rules about what goes in the bill file, and shouldn't the court know about that? Because that would inform us, if only indirectly, about what you most likely intended. In a similar way, you know, should the courts know about the bill drafting conventions from legislative counsel? Wouldn't that help us understand more likely what the legislature intended?
If I read this correctly, and I understand what you're saying, but you don't get to pick and choose, what you're really saying is if the issue were to arise, then it would behoove us, if we were the ones raising the issue through the courts, to say, hey, by the way, there is a staff measure summary. These are the documents that we used in coming to this conclusion, which therefore tells the court, is, I think what you're saying here is, hey, here are documents that you should be looking at.
Precisely.
Okay.
Couldn't have said it better. In some cases, even the very few, actually, only a couple dozen in the 16 years I've been on the bench, the text is really kind of persistently ambiguous. There isn't any legislative history. What do we do? In the courts, we don't have the luxury of simply saying, beats the heck out of me, or can we send this back to Bill Taylor and get an idea of what the legislature most likely intended back then. We have to make a decision. What we have are a series of rules, canons, that when all else fails, we will rely on so that we can make that decision. Those rules are a series of presumptions about what we think the legislature most likely intended. So, for example, if we have a statute and it's ambiguous and it could reasonably mean one thing, it could reasonably mean another thing, one of them would be perhaps unconstitutional and the other not so. We will always err on the side of assuming that the legislature intended to enact the one that's not of doubtful constitutionality. In a similar vein, if you have an ambiguous statute, the legislative history doesn't help, one of the possible constructions would lead to an arguably absurd result. Another would not. We will always assume that the legislature didn't intend to enact the absurd result. The bottom line is that what we have are these rules that are just substitutes for more direct evidence of what the legislature intended. But the guideline is always, what do we think you wanted to do with the statute?
I would also would contemplate that just because there's a staff measure summary that doesn't control, knowing that measure summary actually didn't come from a legislator as being more of someone from staff, unless there's references made by a legislator saying, you know, in reliance on the staff measure summary, this is what we meant, or if you had conflict on the floor in the floor debate where the member is talking from their perspective of what it means as compared to relying on exclusively the staff measure summary. I would assume that the weight would be probably greater toward the statements made by the legislator as compared to the staff members.
Staff wholeheartedly agrees with you on that issue, because we do not want 30 members editing our staff measures on the floor.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I could just add one point to that, and again, it goes back to the statutes that you've given us, because I can understand the desire we all have for a black and white hierarchy. But I think for many of the reasons we've just discussed, it's not quite possible sometimes to be that concrete. In fact, that's what you've told us. If you take a look at ORS 174.020 sub 3, which is on the first page of the statutes, first you say two things that are pertinent here. First, a court may limit its consideration of legislative history to the information that the parties provide to the court. I can tell you, though, sometimes that isn't enough. And so we spend a lot of time going into archives and having our staff dig around to see what else might be there. So we spend an awful lot of time when we're dealing with ambiguous statutes checking out legislative history. But the statute doesn't require us to go beyond what the parties have given us. And the second sentence is the key one. A court shall give the weight to the legislative history that the court considers to be appropriate. So the legislature specifically has not created a formal hierarchy, but the hierarchy, if any, and that's kind of a misuse for the reason that Judge Landau stated, comes from the application in cases based on the evidence that we have in a particular situation. So you've spoken to this. I know our time is limited. The other panel needs to speak, but we haven't heard from Justice Linder. And if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, she has some words, I think, that would be helpful to put some perspective on this.
And that's fine. And before you start, my understanding is that the offices were told that we would go up to 10:30 today to accommodate this presentation. And so even though our time is normally would conclude at 10, unless members have other obligations, we'll stay here up to that time.
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee. My pleasure to be here. I am going to be pretty brief because I think the most important things have really come out through Judge Lando's presentation. I think what follows us is very important for you, too. My role, as I understood it, was to put a little bit of a practical spin on this for you. And if I may, I want to do it not only from my judge's perspective, I want to do it from my perspective as a lawyer who has sort of been engaged in the process of appellate court interpretation statutes for my entire career, beginning in about 1978. When I was a law clerk in the Department of Justice, I began briefing the first issues I would be involved in over the course of my career that were calling on the courts to figure out the meaning of statutes. 1978 was kind of a big time for statutory interpretation because this body, through the 70s, was busy revising the entire criminal code, the criminal procedure code, the juvenile code, and the Administrative Procedures Act. So there was kind of an explosion of issues, if you will, calling on the courts to figure out the meaning of things. I can look back at that with some wonder these days because at that time, if you were a lawyer briefing one of those cases, you just kind of started talking about anything that seemed pertinent. Everybody understood the goal was to figure out the intent of the legislature, but beyond that, it was truly a kind of free-for-all in terms of what you discussed, how you discussed it. I can recall writing briefs that would say things like, the obvious meaning of this term is X, citing nothing for that except linder on obvious meanings. And the court was perfectly comfortable with that. I can say also that when I started practicing as a lawyer, down the hall from me was a guy by the name of Don Paulette, who had been the chair of the Criminal Law Revision Commission. And I would wander down the hall and ask Don what a statute was supposed to mean, and then sometimes I tried to look up something that supported that. That was then. Then around 1993 came PGE, and for those of us who were used to perhaps a more unbridled kind of process for statutory interpretation, PGE and the sort of three-step methodology that Judge Landau has so ably described felt pretty restrictive to those of us trying to make the case for something in the appellate courts. But I can say over time, as restrictive and confining as it may have felt to go through this sequential process in a lockstep kind of way, it made, I believe, ultimately for a much more coherent discussion on the part of advocates and the court itself. So that PGE has persisted to this day, not without criticism. I think that's probably true of any tests, and somebody wiser than I once said that some tests persist not because they're the best test or the only test, it's because they become familiar, and by becoming familiar, they become useful. And beyond that, they often persist because there's no consensus about a better way to do it than a particular test may entail. So PGE, beginning 1993 till now, has persisted, along with a batch of other tests, I might note, that similarly are designed to provide kind of a framework for advocates and the courts to discuss the question of what words mean. And that can arise in constitutional interpretation, contract interpretation. We even have a specialized methodology within our jurisprudence for insurance contract interpretation because that's such a unique kind of beast in its own right. Now, let me kind of add to that then the more judicial, my judge's view of how all of this works. First off, I want to mention a case that the Supreme Court did decide. It reinforces something we've already talked about. It decided in this past year, a case called Mastriano versus Board of Parole, in which the question before the Supreme Court was whether an interpretation of a statute that preexisted PGE was not to be given any kind of precedential weight because of that, because it came before that methodology. And what the court said in that case was PGE wasn't really a brand new thing. It was a distillation, if you will, of a lot of pre-existing rules. As Judge Landau has described it, many of those go back to the DD Code, back to statehood. They've been codified all along. You now see them in Chapter 174. Others have been part of case law since at least Oregon's existence, and they go back to English common law to some degree. And the statutes, in fact, were probably capturing those as well. What PGE did was not come up with new rules per se, but with a way to manage the rules that we have and to go through them in a predictable kind of way. So what I think from my judge's perspective is important to add to all that is there is one other piece to the process for me as a judge, and that is I think it's fair to say that without that kind of a methodology in place, without the set of rules, without the test, we open ourselves as judges to being accused of being ad hoc and just sort of resolving things case by case in a way that looks like it is about our policy preferences instead of about our sincere effort, faithful effort to determine the meaning of this body. And the value of the methodology in part is to provide predictability case to case, because I, just as Judge Landau described, and I think it's true for all of the colleagues I've worked with on the court and hopefully will in the future, we don't become judges because we want your job. We are not judges because we want to make the policy choices, but we are perfectly willing to step up to the plate to assume the job of figuring out the uncertainties and doing our best to provide answers where the uncertainties lie for everybody who deals with those laws in the courts on a day-to-day basis. And so in trying to resolve the uncertainties, what we do on the courts is not just apply PGE, but we write opinions in which we do our best to explain how we went through the process of determining what the legislature meant, and we put that explanation out for the world at large to assess. And then we bind ourselves by it. We do follow the basic rule of stare decisis, let the decision stand, and we will adhere to that, which sets up the kind of conversation between your branch and our branch that Judge Landau described. Having explained ourselves, it is now for the legislature to decide if they like that interpretation. Maybe times have changed, maybe they don't even disagree with it, but they think it's no longer good policy. Maybe the legislature will think we actually got it wrong. But it is then like a very slow dance, your turn to lead and your turn to change the law and revise it in accordance with the policy choice you do want to make. That may again raise new interpretive questions. We will then do our part to figure out the uncertainties, write our explanation, give an answer, and repeat this dance as necessary over the course of years, I guess, when it comes down to it. So there is that aspect to your role in what we do. And then the other important one that we've talked about is right there in Chapter 174. You can, in addition to just revising the substantive policies you make, you also have the ability to put your oar in the water, if you will, on how we should go about that. And you can provide us with some of the interpretive rules that we will apply. You've done that most recently in ORS Chapter 174.020 with some amendments that you added in 2001 that were, Judge Brewer just referred to some of them, about a party's ability to put legislative history before us and our role in dealing with that history. Currently before my court is a case that it has more issues in it than just that issue, but it, among other issues, it has the question of what did those amendments do, if anything, to change the way we should approach the PGE analysis. And this, our court will be writing on that when we decide that case, in addition to the merits of the conviction involved. So we are in partnership in all of this in terms of how we even approach the interpretive question. And our task in that case is to figure out what you meant with the 2001 amendments and the degree to which it changes the way we will go about that. The final thing I just want to mention, because it's come up a little bit, is in this whole effort, I think we recognize words are often very uncertain and very difficult to give such precision to it that nobody can argue over what they mean. And we've talked a lot about legislative history, and I really want to emphasize something that both of my colleagues here have said, which is, in all the years I've done this, so often, more often than not, despite everybody's efforts to anticipate where the disputes over legislation will be, more often than not, we go to legislative history, the parties do, and there is nothing there on the particular dispute that arises, because the disputes are so ongoing. We've just had two days of oral arguments in the Supreme Court, and I just wanted to mention, out of the 8 cases we heard, 3 of them involved questions of statutory interpretation. In those cases, the statutes in question, all of them are at least 25 years old. One of them involves the marital privilege that's been on the books since 1981, I believe. Another one involves the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which has been on the books since the 1960s. And the third one involves the witness tampering statute, which has been on the books since 1971. All 3 questions are questions for which there is no precedent. They are not, for example, the Oregon Tort Claims Act involves the question of the meaning of agency. What is an agent or agency for purposes of a public body's tort immunity? There is no definition of agency, and that question has, in all these years, not come up before. So it is the nature of the business that 40 years later, we still have questions that arise over statutes that you might have thought would have come up long before. They're apparently, based on what the parties have told us, is just not even a whisper of legislative history on what the legislature intended when it used the word agent in that statute. Yes?
I was going to ask a question on that. If, since we're in legislative session, there was some type of legislation that passed that gave some type of legislative history today as to what agency meant, would the court, while it's considering the case that's before you, look at that at this point in time or not?
Chair Przanski, I think I would like to say the court will definitely look at it. It's a question of what weight to put on the the intent of today's legislature, as it should bear on the intent of the legislature 40 years ago that passed the statute.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to, I think in general you will, and I hope Judge Landau will weigh in here, I think in general you will find in the cases a sentiment that says we don't look at the intent of the current legislature to decide what the 140 years ago meant. But
just want to make sure that's on the record.
I think that's basically
right. Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. There are a number of things that say the general rule is what we care about is the enacting legislature's intent, and later statements of later legislatures don't bear on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask for your opinion about the preamble type language, and even in my brief time here, I've been asked multiple times to include several whereas. For example, to use Judge Landau's example, whereas Oregonians like to put frames around their license plate, and whereas, or that type of thing. And legislative counsel tends to say, well, that language doesn't have any force in law. And I've found that the proposals for those tend to come from either one side or the other in contentious issues, wanting to frame where the bill is coming from. And does that type of language help you? It's one more thing to work out and argue about as we go through the process, but how do you view those preambles that are sometimes included in legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, statements of purpose are some evidence of, at least in general terms, what the legislature was thinking about. And so they're going to be useful to that extent. There are two things to think about, though, when you're creating those statements of purpose. One is, do the statements of purpose conflict with the substantive provisions of the bill? And I've seen cases in which that happens and it becomes a problem. To the extent that there's a preamble that conflicts with the operative language of the statute, the operative language will prevail every day. The second thing is you want to pay attention to where the enacting clause is. A lot of times what you say is whereas, be it enacted that, and follow. The stuff that follows the be it enacted clause, that's the law. The stuff that's before it, it's not law. So it's interesting. It may be helpful, but it's not law. What sometimes happens, I've seen this in a number of statutes like the workers' compensation statute, for example, the purpose clause is actually part of the law itself. It's below the be it enacted clause. And then it's part of the statute that is the context for the other operative provisions. It itself is an operative provision, and it just gets put into the mix of the statutory construction problem.
And if I might add, occasionally, not all that often, I think you'll see, the legislature has put a slight interpretive principle into those things, like the provisions of this act will be liberally construed to further da-da-da-da-da. And that kind of thing can certainly add to the mix. Again, if it's part of the be it enacted piece and has been enacted into law.
Thank you.
You were talking about it being the legislature and the judicial being a partnership, and it cuts both ways. I know that you try to narrowly construe your answers to only the question asked, and that's appropriate, but sometimes the answer to the question asked throws a pall over many other statutes as well. And the example that I would bring is the Fort Vinoy. And I don't know, since Fort Vinoy is still under reconsideration, whether it would be even appropriate to talk about it here.
It sort of depends on the question, Senator Whitsitt.
Well, it has to do with Fort Vinoy had to do with an ownership of a water right, whether the holder and the owner means the same thing. And the court decided that through the Supreme Court, that the name that is on the water right certificate is in fact the owner of that water right. But throughout other statutes, it requires that the owner of a water right have the ability to apply that water to the land to which it's appurtenant. And if the name on the water right doesn't have that ability, then it throws the other law out the window, or at least puts it into complete disarray. And this particular decision had to do with the water right in a district, whether the district owned the water right, or whether the land owner of the land to which it was appurtenant owned the water right. But does your decision apply to outside of a district? Obviously, your decision doesn't, but the implication may. We have neighbors all over the state of Oregon who have purchased land, and it was always assumed that the water right would stay appurtenant with the land and the ownership. Your decision creates the suggestion that whosoever name was on the water right when it was actually proved up still owns the water right. They don't have the right to put it to beneficial use because they have no place to put it to beneficial use, but they still own it. In Eastern Oregon, 95-98% of the value, the equity in agricultural land is in the water right. And almost all these properties are leveraged through mortgages.
Besides the argument you're being presented, is there some response you can give us as to the
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I can't comment on the kinds of concerns you're raising, and not only because even if the case were completely done, I wouldn't be able to, because those things may well come into litigation, come before the court. There are, as I'm sure maybe every member of the committee well knows and that you do, there is the ongoing Klamath Basin adjudication as well.
The point wasn't to get into an argument a debate on Fort Benoit. The point was to make the point that often your narrowly construed answer, which is appropriate, creates a plethora of other problems.
Exactly.
If those other statutes aren't taken into consideration during your deliberation.
Exactly. And I think it's fair to say that in those and similar kinds of cases, we as judges are often aware of that problem. We may not be able to anticipate all the ramifications, but I think we know when we are wading, if you will, into the complexities of things like water rights, where we know the litigation is pervasive and the statutes that control them, not only are they a complex scheme, but they are complex with respect to different time frames. Even we're aware of that. We still have to do the best we can within the context. And there are dangers either way. There are dangers in a court answering the narrow question before it so narrowly that it's not seeing the broader issues. Then there's the danger I think we all experience too of what's called overwriting an opinion and beginning to expound on issues that haven't actually come before you and that may look very different when they come before you. That too is part of, I think, the more delicate dance that the two branches of government do, and inherent in one aspect of the court's role, which is case adjudication. We resolve issues in the context only of the case that comes before us. And one of the really foundational principles of courts is we don't have a role in interpreting law outside of the case-specific kind of dispute that comes before us. Perhaps a wise design by our founders, perhaps not, but the one you and we alike are dealt.
Mr. Chair, if I could, we would love, the three of us, frankly, to continue to have a conversation like this with you folks for a long time. What I would like to do is to offer to come back, if that would be helpful. I'm a little concerned that we've got two other colleagues in the back and that you folks need to leave at 10:30 and they haven't had a chance to speak. So I'm wondering if this would be a good time for us to at least thank you for our chance to talk today and to invite them forward. But, of course, leave that to the chair's discretion.
I think that would be appropriate. And I want to thank this panel from all of us as to your time and that you spent with us this morning. And I hope that we can, in fact, let's say, continue the conversations. I know that previously we've been able to maybe come over to your side of the branch of government and maybe have this continued dialogue at another time.
Mr. Chair, we'd very much love to do that. And thank you all so much for your time today. And we'll yield to our colleagues now. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to introduce two of our colleagues today. Seated to my far right is Justice Reeves Kistler of the Oregon Supreme Court, formerly judge on the Court of Appeals, longtime attorney with the Department of Justice, wonderful friend and colleague. And seated in the middle there, to my immediate right, Judge Dave Schumann, who is a colleague on the Oregon Court of Appeals, former Deputy Attorney General, a law professor at the University of Oregon School of Law. These gentlemen are two of the outstanding constitutional scholars in Oregon, and they're here to present a discussion with you about Oregon constitutional law. So thank you very much, colleagues.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving us this opportunity to talk to you necessarily briefly about constitutions and what they are and how they work. I'm going to spend a couple of minutes talking about constitutions in general terms, and then Justice Kistler will address some topics in constitutional law that might be of particular interest to this session of the legislature, and we hope to have time for questions, and feel free to interrupt along the way. And if we run out of time before you run out of questions, we too are happy to come back and continue this conversation. In the American political world, the Constitution is a document that a group of people who happen to be living in a particular place and a particular time draft in order to change themselves from a bunch of people into a people, into a political community. That's how our constitutions began in this country, in the first colonies and states. Constitutions, as we've come to know them, tend to serve three different purposes, which I'll go over very quickly. First of all, they set up the structure of the government. Three branches, the legislature has two houses, et cetera, et cetera. Second, they establish the procedures that each part of government has to use in order to make its actions authoritative. Let me give you an example. If one of you or if I go outside on Court Street and say, speed limit here is 25 miles per hour, that's just words. That's just words. That doesn't mean anything. Those have no legitimate authority. If this body, on the other hand, following the procedures that are spelled out in the Oregon Constitution, produces a law announcing that the speed limit on Court Street is 25 miles an hour, and the governor signs it, that statement is authoritative, and the government can legitimately enforce it, contrary to a citizen's will, through, if necessary, violence. That's the power of the procedures, the sort of hocus-pocus that are involved in how a particular bill becomes a law. It turns mere words into words with the force, the legitimate authority of government behind them. And that's all set out in the Constitution, and in addition, of course, to your own rules. But fundamentally, that is constitutional law. Third function of constitutions, and probably the one that's of most interest and importance to you, and where our interaction becomes most prominent, is the function of limiting government. When people come together to form a government, they agree to relinquish certain freedoms, my freedom to drive 150 miles an hour down Court Street, but they don't relinquish all of their freedoms. There remain some things that individuals can do that government can't interfere with. We call those things rights, and those are spelled out in constitutions. I use the phrase constitutions because, as you know, I'm referring both to the federal and the state constitutions. Let me just begin quickly by mentioning a few of the procedural requirements. I'm sure your committee counsel and legislative counsel advise you quite adequately on these issues. Things like, first of all, I should point out that the United States Constitution imposes no procedural requirements on this body. Your procedures are governed by state law. It's the state law that requires a two-house legislature. There are legislatures in states that have one house, Nebraska, for example. So these are the sorts of things that I'm talking about. A two-house legislature, quorum necessary to do business, open floor sessions, revenue bills have to originate in the House, passed by three-fifths in each chamber. A single subject rule, every act shall embrace but one subject and matters properly connected, that sort of thing. Let me talk for a little bit in somewhat more detail about the substantive limitations that are imposed on the legislature by constitutions. I have sort of our job is somewhat more unpleasant than the prior panel because most of what we're telling you is what you can't do. That's the nature of constitutions, although that's only half the nature, as the things I've talked about so far, what they authorize you to do. But the power of a state legislature is limited by both the federal constitution and the state constitution. As Judge Landau pointed out, the federal constitution contains an article that says that this constitution, the federal constitution, and laws passed pursuant thereto are the supreme law of land. That means if there's a conflict between the United States Constitution or United States federal statute or, in fact, a federal regulation in Oregon law loses, even if it's Oregon constitutional law. The Oregon Constitution is trumped by federal regulation promulgated by elected bureaucracy, for example. That's just inherent in Article 6 of the federal Constitution. Now, the conflict can be direct. For example, if federal law says that discrimination based on age is unlawful, and Oregon should pass a law prohibiting people over the age of 60 from driving an automobile, that would be a direct conflict. It can also be implied. You can look at federal law on some subjects and say it is just obvious that federal law occupies the entire field of, for example, foreign policy. There's no statute that says the states can't have a foreign policy, but that's the way it is, just because the federal government has occupied that field entirely. Another common limitation outside of the Bill of Rights that the federal Constitution imposes on state governments is the regulation of commerce. Even if there is no federal law on some subject, the state legislature cannot pass a law on that subject if doing so unduly interferes with interstate commerce. Famous example that those of you who are lawyers remember from Constitutional Law 1, a state passes a law saying all trucks in this state have to have curved mud flaps. Well, as it turned out, the surrounding states had laws requiring straight mud flaps. All of those laws were unconstitutional. That's an area that quite literally governs interstate commerce. And the states are not allowed to legislate in that area, even if there's no federal law that says mud flaps can be either curved or straight or something like that. The most substantive limitations on state legislatures imposed by the federal Constitution are, of course, in the Bill of Rights. Most of the rights set out in the first 9 amendments to the United States Constitution, plus the 14th Amendment, establish areas of personal autonomy or individual freedom into which no government, neither the state government, nor the federal government, nor local government, can intrude. As you all know, the First Amendment prohibits laws limiting free speech. The Fifth Amendment prohibits laws compelling self-incrimination, et cetera, et cetera. The 14th Amendment prohibits laws that deny the equal protection of the laws. In addition to all limitations imposed by the federal Constitution, there are substantive restrictions on state legislatures imposed by the state Constitution over and above and in addition to the restrictions imposed by the United States Constitution, mostly in the area of individual rights. The rights that are guaranteed to Oregon citizens by the United States Constitution establish an area of personal freedom into which state government cannot intrude. But the state is free to enlarge that area to create more personal freedom than the minimum guaranteed by the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution, as we say, establishes a floor but not a ceiling. So the states are free to give their citizens an additional measure of the same rights that the federal Constitution gives. For example, in Oregon, the Oregon Free Speech Guarantee is phrased in terms that are much broader than the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and the Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution has been construed that way. The Oregon Equality Guarantee applies to gender discrimination in exactly the same way that it applies to racial discrimination. That's not true under federal law. Under federal law, gender discrimination is more permissible than racial discrimination. Under Oregon's constitution, women have a more equal portion of rights than they do under the federal constitution. Furthermore, the states can give their citizens rights that the federal constitution simply doesn't have at all. For example, in Oregon, every citizen has the right to a remedy in due course of law for injury to person, property, or reputation. There's no comparable right under the United States Constitution. I believe Justice Kistler might talk about that right when he's...
Might
not. Oregon's Constitution contains a large measure of rights for crime victims. You don't find those in the United States Constitution. So Basically, those are the kinds of limitations that are imposed on the legislature by the Oregon Constitution. There are some additional ones imposed by the separation of powers, but those are so obscure that they don't happen very much. So, in summary, a constitution is called a constitution because that's what constitutes a people. It constitutes, organizes, and limits government. Limitations are either procedural, that is, imposing restrictions on how laws are made, or substantive, that is, imposing restrictions on what kinds of law can be enacted. Under the United States Constitution, states can't enact laws that conflict with federal laws, that unduly interfere with interstate commerce, or that violate individual rights. Under the Oregon Constitution, states cannot enact laws that violate the Oregon Bill of Rights or some other peripheral sorts of things like separation of powers.
That was the quick one-semester course from Professor Schumann on the Constitution. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I want to do in the brief time that we have is to maybe put a slightly different spin on what Judge Schumann said and actually invite questions from the committee. It seems to me that our role here is to help the committee and the legislature figure out how to pass the bills it wishes to do consistently with the Constitution. And so it's not so much about what you can't do, although there are some things you can't do, but how to do the things you want to do and do it in a manner that's constitutionally permissible. Towards that end, I was going to talk about two areas, but I know that last time we were in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, they had their own questions about things that were on their minds, and I didn't want, in the few minutes we have left, take my time talking about something that wasn't an issue in front of you. So what I wanted to do was to start out by inviting questions from the committee if they had any, and if you don't, you'll be subject to hearing what I was planning to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I wanted to clarify was Judge Schumann's comments. The people tell the government what the government is empowered to do. The government doesn't tell the people what the people are empowered to do. So the Constitution, is my understanding, does not establish rights. The Constitution, rather, specifically guarantees certain rights that are retained by the people that the people never ceded to the government in the first place. And I think, to me, that's a lot of the crux of what we do in this legislature. We need to understand what the sideboards are. We are only empowered by the people to do certain things.
I think that's correct. There may be a little bit of both, and I let Judge Schumann, who's the professor, speak more to it. But my understanding is that in the federal Constitution, where it's a government of limited powers, the Constitution authorizes the legislature or the Congress only to do certain kinds of acts, to act in certain areas, and reserves the rest of those areas to the states. State constitutions are actually a little broader because the states have plenary power to address all those issues. So in some senses, state constitutions give the legislature the power that's broader than the federal, although, as Judge Schumann said, if they conflict, the federal will control. But we get to address areas that the federal government doesn't get to address. In that sense, I think you're perfectly correct that they do empower the legislature to address a broad range of topics that concern the citizens of the state. They also, however, do contain some limitations on what the government may do and preserve rights to the people, such as the right to be free in the privacy of your home so that the government can't come in unless it has a good reason or a warrant to enter your home and invade your privacy. So it may have both pieces to it. And state constitutions are also a little bit unusual because they address a number of subjects such as printing offices, where the government may contract for printing, how we issue certain bills and limits on, say, bonding and other kinds of things the legislature can do. But I think you're right that it certainly does confer rights, but it also, or reserve rights to the people, but it also may place some limits on the kinds or types of legislation that can be enacted.
What frequently you'll see constitutions referred to as charters. A charter is a kind of contract, and so in other words, you put your finger exactly on one of the contract elements of the Constitution. The people gather together and decide that they will relinquish certain of their freedoms in order to receive in return the benefits of living in a community and being protected. But they don't give up everything. They retain certain things, and that's part of the contract. We will give up our freedom to drive 150 miles an hour down Court Street in return for the safety that will inure to everybody by having that kind of law. But we don't give up our right to privacy and the freedom of our own home. That's not part of the deal.
Because I guess one of the things at least the framers of the first Congress was concerned about, and it's reflected in our Constitution too, is they were concerned the government might overreach in certain circumstances. And so they wanted to put specific protections in to keep the government from overreaching. And so that's where I think the limitations come from, if I've got it right.
And that had to do with the federal government overreaching to the states. And that's why the 10th Amendment says that those powers not explicitly given to the federal government are reserved to the states.
Ron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting, you raised charter that comes out of British common law, and whole historical thing, almost back to the Roman Empire. And so I guess my questioning kind of is in that frame. I mean, you said the Constitution, it sets the structure, sets the procedures, and then, it limits the government on what it can do based on what freedoms we have given up to empower them to do. Having said that, in various times in history, the last most that strikes me is the Great Depression, which is, of course, kind of why I'm raising this question here. Given those parameters, the people elected representatives who went to the Constitutional Convention, who then adopted a constitution, which was then ratified by a group of legislators in multiple states who were elected by the people, that's going up the chain. So my question is there really anyone who can suspend the Constitution? And if so, who can do that? Because if you suspend the Constitution, what I understand you saying, you no longer have procedures, you no longer have legitimacy.
My memory, and I'm always in thin ice when I tread on my memory, rely on my memory, but my memory is the first section of Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution provides that the people retain the right to suspend the Constitution at any point in time. I suppose that if we suspended our Constitution, we would presumably either call a constitutional convention in order to enact a new constitution, and you would actually have to somehow get rid of the existing one. So you would have to probably have some sort of procedure like a constitutional convention or a constitutional revision, because I think if you got rid of the constitution, that's more than an amendment and certainly probably a revision or a new constitution. And so I think you'd have to have some sort of body that would gather, and this is, my guess, that would then take action to both change the existing constitution or get rid of it and then adopt a new one. But until you do that, the existing constitution, I think, would control. My memory is that Article 1, Section 1 doesn't set out the procedures by which you do suspend the constitution. It may be set out in later pieces. Federal constitution, my guess is that we can't suspend it unless you simply have to go with it unless there is some formal amendment process as they specify in that Constitution.
The provision of the Oregon Constitution that Justice Kistler is referring to is in Article 1, Section 1. It says the people have at all times a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper. Now, hearing that, you would presume that means that the legislature could enact statutes for altering and abolishing the Constitution. As it turns out, there's provisions later in the Constitution that spell out exactly how that has to happen. Now, that, of course, raises the interesting historical problem, which is that when a government, when the people decide that their constitutionally formed government is no longer serving its purpose, they get rid of it. Not through constitutional means, but through revolution, and that happens in other parts of the world regularly. It has never happened in the United States.
And hopefully it won't be an issue that comes before this committee in the coming session.
We're not planning on it yet.
Is there something, Brian, that you're not telling us?
You know, the reason I raise that question is, I mean, during the Great Depression, as you're constitutional scholars, you can probably cite it better than me, the president, or we'll just say hypothetically a governor or somebody who suspended portions of the Constitution for various reasons, and of course, the U.S. Supreme Court later said, no, you can't do that, but, oh, well, that's just the way life goes. They suspended portions of the Constitution, and we did what they told us to do because we didn't have any choice. And so, but in a body of law, technically it can't be done, is what you're saying. The people, in some manner, must do it.
Correct. And the United States Constitution does allow the suspension, for example, of the writ of habeas corpus in certain very narrowly limited circumstances. But I don't think there's anything in either the federal or the state constitution that allows the legislature to selectively suspend the operation of portions of the Constitution. I think there's statutes that permit the governor to have extraordinary powers in times of emergency. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty much it, if I'm remembering correctly.
Could you follow up on that just briefly? The governor, because I served in emergency services, so the governor could have extraordinary powers, but he still must comply with the Constitution.
Yeah, I think so.
It's
yeah.
laws he yeah. can do, not constitutions. Is that correct?
Yeah.
To follow up on what Senator Boulkus was saying, if you look at the presidential executive orders from 1964 through 1979, most of which are still in place from Jack Kennedy on, there's a plethora of executive orders that give the president the right to suspend the various different protections of the Constitution, including the bear arms, peacefully assemble, free speech. It's a fascinating array if you'd like to look at it sometime. And I think that's what he's getting at, does the Constitution really trump the executive's ability to make such proclamations or not?
Well, you know, my guess offhand would be that the executive would have a hard hill to climb to say that he was permitted to do that. But at least as I understand our structure, at least what the courts do, is we sit to hear claims by people who believe that the executive has exceeded his or her authority. So that if there is a claim that the executive has suspended pieces of the Constitution in ways that are not permissible, then the courts sit, and I think there are a series of actually habeas corpus actions following the Civil War, in which the federal government attempted to place certain restrictions, and you get actions coming up from the people saying, you can't hold me without giving me my constitutional rights, and the courts sit to determine whether those are valid suspensions of the Constitution. So at least we're here, I think our goal is to attempt to enforce the Constitution and to make sure that if the executive or the legislature takes actions that exceed their authority under the Constitution, then those actions are declared either to whether they do or don't comply with it.
Thank you.
We are getting closer to the 10:30 time, so I'm going to ask if there's something else you'd like to share with us that we haven't been able to cover.
Not unless I was going to talk about Article 1, Section 8, but I think that if the committee doesn't have questions that go there, there's no point in taking the committee's valuable time to address that. So it's fine by me. And so I think we're perfectly happy to come back at a later time also.
Go ahead.
See if I can get an answer in the next couple of minutes to this. Justice Kissler, you mentioned something about our need to be aware of, we want to pass bills that are consistent with the Constitution, and typically we rely on legislative counsel to let us know if we submit something and there's a constitutional red flag, but obviously there's some things that get up to the court and they're challenged on constitutional grounds. So are there certain things that we should watch for, certain topic areas, certain red flags that we should be aware of as well?
I was thinking more of what I was saying about Article 1, Section 8, because I think in a way Article 1, Section 8 is a provision that limits in some senses how you write your laws. In other words, if you write the law and you say this kind of speech is prohibited, you're going to probably run afoul of Article 1, Section 8, or have a very, very hard time sustaining it. If you write a law that prohibits the effect rather than the speech itself, you'll probably write a law that has, you know, a very good chance of being constitutional. So the thought was that, in a way, our role is not to simply say what you can't do,
but in a way, if we have a partnership, as Justice Linder said, and there you have to be careful limits about how you discuss pending bills, because that's probably the appropriate place is your council. But there certainly the Constitution may also be a roadmap of how to achieve what you want as much as a block to getting where you want to go. And hopefully that's how the judiciary and the legislature can work together.
Thank you.
And I think our final word is going to come from our own council tonight.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this probably is not a problem for members that have been around a while, but it will be always a problem for new legislators in the area of free speech, and that is what can be regulated under the federal constitution, and many state constitutions cannot be regulated to the same extent in Oregon. And that causes a lot of angst with new members, but I know we've all been through the drill before. And if I could take one more second for some housekeeping things that I forgot. One, I've got a sign-up sheet because we're applying for CLE credit. If you haven't signed up and you've sat through the presentation, remember the Oregon State Law, we're going to apply for 2 CLE credits. The other thing is, we were talking about staff measure summaries. We're happy to go down and sit with you on the floor, but we would appreciate it if you'd request our presence, because I've sat down there for 2 hours only to sit next to someone and said, what are you here for? I don't really need you. So as you know, we get deep into session. We can spend hours down there. We're glad to help you. Just please request it.
Yeah, the chair wants to, I guess, fortify that because of the demands with our council serving on both sides. The last thing we need to do is have them sitting there listening to our floor debates when we don't really need them there. So, members, if you are carrying a bill, I am going to ask you to please let the judiciary staff know that you want them there if you have a need for them to be present. And if not, we can always stop the process where we're at and have someone come up. We've done that before, and so I'd rather err on the side of giving the flexibility to the staff and not having them just sit on the side for no useful purpose.
One further thing, Mr. Chair. It's been the practice of this committee that members ask for this, too, and that is that members bring copies of the bills. We will supply you with the staff measure summaries, the fiscal impact statements, and the revenue impact statements, and any testimony that we receive in advance. That's been the practice. It can change. Unlike Ways and Means, we do not supply you with notebooks. Years ago, members said they did not want us to pass out copies of the bills because it was a waste of paper because they were bringing their own. But that's our process and procedure. From past experience, it can be changed, but that's what we're planning to do until it's instructed differently on Tuesday.
All right. Any other comments? My understanding, we're scheduled to meet on Monday. Have we actually set a time for our Monday meeting?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not have a meeting for Monday.
Monday is Martin Luther King Day, where our first meeting is on Tuesday.
Okay. All right. With that, we'll close. First, I want to thank you all very, very much for being part of the presentation today. And the constitutional part is always one of the most interesting parts for all of our members, whether we've got the legal training or not. So thank you very much for being here, and we look forward to seeing you later in the session.
Thank you very much for having us.
And with that, we're going to close today's Senate Committee on Judiciary.
And prior to that, committee chair used to take
Wow.